from the number one sports site in the world. Yahoo! This is Yahoo Sports Radio. YahooSportsRadio.com.
Welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
The ball, Yelovich, is an own goal! It's an own goal!
With your host, Joe Manko. From Yahoo Sports and Yahoo Sports Radio.
It's Friday! It's a landslide!
Joe Manko and all the insiders from the FC Yahoo Soccer Blog bring you coverage of soccer across the world.
Premier League,
MLS,
Champions League,
La Liga,
Serie A,
and Bundesliga. It's all the coverage from soccer across the world.
This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
Oh, it's going in!
Right now.
Incredibly, within seconds.
From the Yahoo Sports headquarters in Playa Vista, California, here's your host, Joe Manko.
Greetings, soccer fans. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, episode number 7. I'm Joe Manko, editor of the FC Yahoo Soccer blog. With me here in the Playa Vista podcasting room is Joey Galino.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back.
And as always, in New York, Leander Scharlakens.
I'm wondering if we should start the show with a minute of silence for Johan Cruyff, but that probably wouldn't make for very good listening.
It wouldn't, but we are going to offer our tributes to Johan Cruyff. We are taping on the day that the Ajax, Barca, and Dutch legend passed at the age of 68 from a battle with cancer. Leander, let's why don't you start us off on just how would you assess Cruyff's place in the game of soccer? Just how immense of a figure was he?
Well, not just in the home country that he and I shared, the Netherlands, where he was a towering figure, but I think worldwide he impacted the sport in a way that I'm not entirely sure anybody else has. Because even back as a player, he was kind of the orchestrator of Total Football, which was devised by his longtime coach and mentor, Rinus Michels, with Ajax, and then with the Dutch national team, which took them to a World Cup final. And then again at Barcelona, where they found a way to blend Total Football with sort of a more Spanish sensibility, you know, with the short passes and everything. And that really laid the foundation of the Barcelona that, or of the success that Barcelona is still enjoying to this day. And then I think that as a coach, he sort of helped cement that at both Ajax and Barcelona again. And he was really instrumental in setting up Barcelona's youth academy, La Masia, which then would go on to produce the first player that came out of it was Pep Guardiola. And would then eventually produce the likes of Xavi and Andres Iniesta and Lionel Messi. So his legacy is not just as one of the greatest players of all time, and he's generally considered one of the three best, along with Pelé and Diego Maradona, but also somebody who really shaped the sport long after his playing days were over, because he had such a profound impact on the way it evolved and then on the way it would keep evolving after he stopped playing.
Yeah, I think the best way for me to approach this personally is to say that you mentioned Pelé and Maradona. Those are the two big names that a lot of people in our particular corner of the world here in the United States know. But Johan Cruyff was just as influential as them, and probably more so. And I think to my own playing days when, you know, I never played at a really high level. I played in high school. When I was starting out as a freshman, you know, like I was an outside back. And our coach encouraged me to kind of get forward. And, you know, we'd have someone come in and there'd be positional interchangeability there. And I was fortunate enough, and you guys were too, to kind of be born into a world where this game that we love had all of these tenets to it where there's interchangeability and tactical flexibility, and it's not so proper and rigid of a formation. And, you know, our own Shahan Ahmed on Twitter had a great line. He said, you know, without Johan Cruyff, the beautiful game would be a lot less beautiful. What we know as this sport today is a lot because of what he did in the 70s and professing that total football. And then, you know, not just as a player, but as Leander mentioned, then he kind of was the primogenitor of this Barcelona dominance and Pep Guardiola and all that. So his impact is, you don't have to look hard for it. You just look around at the sport as it's constituted today, because a lot of that is because of him, and, you know, we can't thank him enough for that.
Guys, we're also taping the day before the U.S. men's national team resumes World Cup qualifying. The Americans will be playing a home-and-home series effectively against Guatemala. They start off in Guatemala City. But we're going to spend really the rest of this podcast to assess and analyze really the tenure of Jurgen Klinsmann as the U.S. men's national team coach. So for those who are listening, you probably saw the headline of the podcast. Dig in. Get ready, because we're really going to go back to day one when Klinsmann was hired, and really have an honest conversation. So let's go back to the day when Klinsmann was hired. It was July 29th, 2011. Klinsmann was named as the new USMNT coach to replace Bob Bradley, and on that day, Sunil Gulati, the U.S. soccer president, said these words about Klinsmann in a statement. Gulati said, "He is a highly accomplished player and coach with the experience and knowledge to advance the program. Jurgen has had success in many different areas of the game, and we look forward to the leadership he will provide on and off the field." So let's go back in our time machine.
Way back machine.
And try to remember what were the expectations for Jurgen Klinsmann back then on that day in July of 2011?
Well, I was actually there the day that he was introduced at a sporting goods store, which does not sponsor our podcast, so I won't give them a name check, in Midtown in Manhattan. And there were obviously dozens of reporters and lots of TV cameras. And actually, just thinking back to it, I remember somebody from U.S. Soccer who was getting ready to introduce Klinsmann. And he got up on stage and he turns on the mic and he says, "Is everybody excited?" And that was a weird thing to say to reporters, because, you know, no cheering in the press box and all that. But also it was sort of the mood at the time where, you know, Bob Bradley, I think history will look on his legacy very, very kindly. I think he was a good coach. I think that he got a lot out of modest talent. And it was predictable, and yes, it was boring sometimes. And even though the U.S. actually scored quite a lot of goals, it wasn't very exciting most of the time. But he did a good job, and people had sort of grown tired of that. And the words that you heard again and again and again back then was the next level. And Jurgen was going to take us to the next level. And we weren't really sure what the next level was, but he was going to take us there. And so there was a lot of excitement that maybe in retrospect, he wasn't responsible for directly. That was sort of created by us, the media, and by the fans, and certainly by U.S. soccer itself. And so he started talking about proactive, or as he would pronounce it, proactive soccer, and how everything was going to look prettier, and he was going to integrate more Latin American players into the team. Well, I should say, you know, players with Central American or North American roots, and sort of make it reflect the American melting pot a little bit more, and it was all going to be high pressure and up tempo, and that's what we were promised. And so I think that kind of brings us to this podcast today, where that's a very different picture from what we're seeing now.
U.S. fans were ready for change, and you know, Jurgen was hired finally on July 29th, 2011, but he was always rumored to be the replacement, or the ideal replacement, the leading candidate maybe, as Bradley's successor. And I think, Joe, you can speak to this, but I think a lot of U.S. Fans, in their minds, they had this kind of idyllic world of where Klinsmann can take the U.S. senior team. He had this success with Germany, you know, albeit with Yogi Love is really being the mastermind. And it's been said that Klinsmann was more of a motivator, a master motivator at that. But people were tired of seeing this defensive style of soccer under Bradley, and they were ready for something new. They're ready for something, I guess, positive and something more attacking. Now, would you agree with that, Joey? I mean, I'm just trying to establish what U.S. Yeah. fans wanted and were hoping back then.
I was thrilled the day that he was announced as the manager, and it's not because I had anything against Bob Bradley. I almost feel like when you referenced where Klinsmann could take the United States was more of what I was thinking. I wasn't really thinking first and foremost about tactics, about how it would look. In my mind, I kind of had pie-in-the-sky dreams of like a World Cup semifinal in 2014, however unrealistic that might have been. And it was also, ever since, you know, the United States was so dormant in soccer from about 1950 to 1990, when the United States qualified for the World Cup again after all those years. And, you know, the Borla Milutinovic team that got out of the first round, or got out of the group stage in 94, was kind of the big, you know, that was such a huge event, and it kind of showed people a glimpse of potential of what we could be as a soccer nation. Then you go into Steve Sampson, Bruce Arena, Bob Bradley, and for all of the success that they had, they were American coaches. They were guys who, you know, Jurgen Klinsmann kind of represented this European figure who had had a lot of success both as a player and a manager. And so it was a little bit of a change up. And I guess in my own mind, and some of the other fans I talked to at the time, it sort of represented the next step. It's kind of like, okay, now that the United States has a base and an infrastructure and is ready to experience this kind of success, let's go out and get somebody who might be able to deliver that to us. So early on, when it was announced, yes, I was very, very high on the Jurgen Klinsmann hiring.
It's funny because if you think about it now, and you just made me realize it, Joey, Klinsmann was the first big hire U.S. soccer has ever made.
Yeah.
Nobody knew who Bora was, and nobody really cared in the mid-90s. And like you say, Arena was an MLS guy. He'd come from UVA. He'd come from DC United. You know, it's just this was the first time where the U.S. made a hire that anybody really outside of the small soccer circle at the time really cared about. And so he sort of became a vessel for all of our hopes and dreams for the national team and what it could possibly be, realistically or not. And we could probably argue most convincingly for the latter.
And exactly. It wasn't that those previous guys were bad necessarily. It was just it was almost like the United States, thanks to the contributions of the Steve Sampsons, Bruce Arenas, Bob Bradleys, it was like the United States was ready finally to be able to go out and get someone of Klinsmann's stature, whatever that may be.
Yeah, and I think bringing in a foreign coach, I think people were ready for new and fresh ideas, right?
Yeah.
I think that's we had seen what American coaches can do. Granted, they understood, you know, the whole convoluted, confusing landscape of American soccer.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, let's bring in someone from the outside, someone who we saw have some level of success as the German national team coach. I think people had big expectations because, one, he was a former star striker. He had won a World Cup as a player. He had the success with Germany and Yogi Love. And, you know, and the stuff, you know, just negativity around Bob Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just think back to the way it was. Like, Bob Bradley could not do anything
right.
toward the end. You know, the Jonathan Bornstein thing was the one that people like to bring up all the time.
I know I did.
but it really, I felt bad for Bob. And the fact that he was, I think this is a big point about Bob, or people's perception about Bob. He wasn't the most charismatic guy.
Right.
He didn't dazzle you with his press conferences. He didn't have any sound bites. Jurgen, you know, up until what we knew of Jurgen then, we knew he was this personality, right? That he was able to be engaging, and
right.
I think that's an aspect that excited the U.S. M&T fan base.
And I think that it was unfair to Bob Bradley, but that was right after the 2011 Gold Cup final. And when you get, you know, housed by Mexico like that, you're going to have a lot of emotion that's not necessarily undue, but is maybe misplaced. You can't let that one game kind of cast a pall over everything that Bob Bradley did, but that was certainly a factor at the time with the Klinsmann hire. And also, to kind of just extend your point, Joe, real quick, is that us as American soccer fans, we'd like to see our guys, you know, it's great for the growth of MLS. We'd love to see MLS get better and better. But it'd be really good to see some of our guys, and they have, go across the pond and try to ply their trade in the very best leagues in Europe. And this was almost on a superficial, maybe, level, something along those lines, where we got someone who has experience with those leagues and experience with the very top echelon of the game coming over to kind of help us out. And at least that was the dream at that time.
Right. I mean, from a reporter standpoint, and I'm under no illusions that that's a viewpoint shared by all the fans, but the funny thing was that Bradley was famous for not saying anything in press conferences, and he was sort of unabashed about that. I mean, he didn't really care to speak to the press and to tell them what he was doing. Jurgen likewise gives away almost nothing, but he talks and talks and talks. He sort of talks around the point, and he dances around it just as Bradley did. The only difference is he does it with a smile and a European accent. And I think that Jurgen has gotten away with a lot that Bradley wouldn't have. A, because there was that hype, and B, because there was always the stigma about Bradley that he was the guy who the job fell to, mm-hmm. because Klinsmann didn't want it or wasn't available. Klinsmann basically turned it down, and then Bradley became the coach. So he was always coach plan B. But with Jurgen, you know, he's a charming guy. And, you know, as a Dutchman, I don't get to say that about Germans very often, but he really is. I mean, I've spent a decent amount of time around him now, and he's always super energetic and optimistic and friendly and outgoing, and he's totally unruffled by anything. And he's a guy who sort of, you know, has life by insert vulgarity here. But you know, Bradley just kind of had this sort of, even though he could be very pleasant and friendly, he had this kind of dour disposition. And that made it, I think, harder to believe in him and to give him the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, we're humans and we respond to friendliness in other humans. And I think that's a big part of the difference between them.
All right, let's fast forward to 2014, which was really Klinsmann's first big goal and test, was to qualify for the World Cup. They did. They got drawn, however, in a very difficult group, along with Ghana, Portugal,
and Germany.
And so expectations were really low. In the lead up to Brazil, however, I think this was the moment where Klinsmann was making a statement, where he wanted to say, this is my team. And where I'm going with this is, he did not choose Landon Donovan mm-hmm. for the roster for the World Cup. Now, all of the promotions, marketing around the U.S. team revolved around, for the most part, the guy wearing the number 10 jersey, Landon Donovan. And I mean, I think we should revisit this, because for those of us who were in Palo Alto, I remember talking to the chatter at the time at that camp was Landon's role would be coming off the bench. And I remember Tim Howard talking, someone had asked Tim Howard, how important is Landon Donovan to this team? And he said, he's so important that he is one of the two most important players that I trust on this team being on the field. I think, I want to say Bradley or Deuce was, Clint Dempsey was the other. Do you remember, Leander?
I remember Michael Bradley saying that without Landon Donovan, this tournament for us will not be longer than 3 games, which as it turned out it was, but I mean, he certainly had the support of the core of the team.
So Donovan doesn't go. It shocks. I think it's safe to say it shocked U.S. soccer. He brings on. He includes a teenage Julian, a 19-year-old Julian Green.
He was still 18 when they announced
18, the roster. From who was doing well for Bayern Munich's youth sides. But had yet to really do anything of significance for the senior team. They go to Brazil. They surprise, I guess, people by going through the group and playing a very hard-fought, entertaining game against Belgium that really could have been more lopsided than the 2-1 extra time result. For those who remember, Tim Howard, using a hockey term, stood on his head as the U.S. goalie,
setting
a World Cup record for saves. I think it was at 16 at the time, but they adjusted it to 15. Yeah. He becomes the star, the hero of the U.S. World Cup. Everyone comes away thinking of this, the U.S. having a positive result, a positive tournament. President Obama talks to Tim Howard and Clint Dempsey right after the game, and everyone's happy that the U.S. Was able to make it out of their group and be entertaining and playing basically Bob Bradley style of soccer. So, how should Klinsmann's how should that World Cup under Klinsmann be judged? Is it thumbs up or thumbs down?
Well, I think I'm going to hold my thumb horizontally, which is a cop-out, but I accept that. To go back to Green for a minute, the extraordinary thing there was, first of all, he played 3 minutes of senior team soccer with Bayern Munich, and he had played something like a half hour with the U.S. He'd made his debut that April against Mexico in a friendly. I believe it was in Arizona. And he had taken a spill in that game, and he kind of looked totally unprepared for that level, either that or totally overwhelmed, but neither one was a particularly promising omen. And I remember he sort of looked like a newborn horse or a calf or whatever you call it, where like he could barely find his feet. And he fell and he separated his shoulder. And what I found out from Jurgen Klinsmann's assistant, Andy Herzog, who's probably sometimes too candid for the program's good, he told me that Green actually hadn't been fit to play until that round of 16 game against Belgium, that his separated shoulder was so bad that he wasn't available for those first 3 games at the World Cup. So not only did Klinsmann leave the greatest player in American soccer history, I think we can say that without qualifiers, certainly he had more goals and way more assists than anybody else, he left him at home for an 18-year-old at the time who was inexperienced and who wasn't fit and who wasn't even close to fit. And that's pretty grievous to me. And then you go to this World Cup and, yeah, the U.S. gets results, but they get badly outplayed in 3 or 4 games. The only reason that game against Belgium was entertaining is because Tim Howard was putting on a show. If he has, 10% less of a good day, that's a 5-0 game. And it's a blowout and people turn off their TVs at halftime. I think that you look at the results, yeah, that was a pretty good World Cup. But you sit back and watch those games and it was a bit of a slaughter.
I think that I agree with a lot of what you say. I'm going to have my thumb up for this one and I'll get into that in a second. First, a word on the Landon Donovan omission. That was like the first time that Klinsmann, as you said, he's a very personable guy. Some might call it arrogance, and this was a huge power play to do that and kind of shake things up. And while that works managerially and coaching-wise from time to time, he needed to get out of the group stage. He needed to do something here or else that would have been even more scrutinized of a move than it already was. And going into this World Cup, I do think I don't like it when people say that what happened in this World Cup is the same thing that happened in 2010. Because if you want to say get out of the group, eliminated in a round of 16, yes, by strict definition, the same thing did happen. However,
extra time of round of the 16.
Yes, exactly. Extra time around of 16. But for me, there is a marked difference between playing in a group with Algeria, Slovenia, and England, and a group with the eventual World Cup winners, Germany, Portugal, and Ghana. And to get out of that, that was the group of death. It was either that or Group C, which I think had Uruguay, Italy, England, and Costa Rica in it. So those were the two toughest groups. And for the United States to not only the U.S. got out of it, but it was also in position to win it thanks to the way that results broke heading into the Portugal match, or at least to clinch a spot in the round of 16 heading into the Portugal match if there would have been a win. And I think, you know, results-wise, it's kind of easy to forget with all the buzzy moments that emerged from that World Cup, Tim Howard's performance, the two goals against Portugal, the John Brooks header. The only game the U.S. won was the first game. The U.S. didn't win any of the other games. Now, that's – but again, this – just being in this group and getting out of that group, I thought, was very successful. And the U.S. really, and regardless of what you want to say about handshake agreements or winks, nods, whatever, between the U.S. and Germany to guarantee that both got through to the round of 16 in the final group stage match, the U.S. played them pretty tough. It took a great finish by Thomas Muller into the lower left-hand corner to give Germany a 1-0 victory there. And I think once you get past that stage, playing Belgium in the round of 16 is different than playing Ghana in the round of 16. And what I mean by that is I think that Belgium may not be a huge name worldwide, but we know they have incredible talent. They have almost a golden generation of players right now. And it kind of underscored the tiers that there are in world soccer. You've got the very top, maybe the Germanys and the Spains, and you know, if you want to throw Brazil and Argentina maybe in there right now. Then you've got the second tier of you know, Belgium and some other nations. Then I think the United States, that game proved, is comfortably below on that third tier. And I agree with you. I'm glad you guys brought this up because the U.S. actually got very much outplayed in that Belgium game. Tim Howard had to have the game of his life to make it even be close. And I also think that the Wando miss, I hate to bring this up because we all love Chris Wondolowski, but that also underscores right there. If you have, and I'm not saying Luis Suarez's and players like that grow on trees, but if you are one of those elite nations, you have that kind of player that maybe puts away one of those two chances or puts away the ball that Clint Dempsey got really late in the second extra time, and it's a different story from there on out. But I do think that it's not like for like. This tournament was more successful than the 2010 tournament, even though the U.S. did win the group in 2010. And it's because of who the U.S. played, and I think how everything was kind of crystallized in terms of like the tiers of you know, the levels that the U.S. wants to get to.
I'm going to give the results of the World Cup a thumbs up. But as for how they played, I'm leaning towards a thumbs down because it wasn't any different from what we saw with Bob Bradley. I think, you know, go back to this next level business, Leander. I didn't see any. It was the same level. It was the same, you know, American type soccer where we're gonna defend for our lives and, you know, we're gonna, you know, give it our all in this effort and you know, we're never gonna be the team that tires, and that's great and everything, but yeah, after that Belgium game, you know, Jurgen said he was asked, you know, why didn't the U.S. go forward? Why didn't they take the game to Belgium? And what he said was, well, I tried to get them. Essentially, said I tried to tell them to do that, but they wouldn't listen to me, and right. That is not a great answer.
No.
You know, it's your job to get these. Get your team to play the way you want them to, and sure, if the U.S. goes forward, they were going to get blown out, and maybe the players knew that. Maybe that there was they were reluctant to go forward because they, you know, whenever any time, you know, Belgium was working the ball easily through them and creating chances.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, for me, was the biggest point of contention with Klinsmann, and it. I think that kind of snowballed in 2015, where there just wasn't, you know, you didn't see this next level attacking soccer. It was the same stuff. And so 2015 was when, last year was when everything kind of went sideways on Jurgen. He began the year at the January camp stating the goals of, one, winning the Gold Cup, which would, two, get them to the Confederations Cup in 2017. And the third goal was for the under-23s to qualify for the Rio Olympics. Now, we all know what happened. They went 0 for 3. There's still a chance for them, for the under-23s to qualify. They have a home-and-home with Colombia that begins on Friday, tomorrow. But, you know, what was the biggest reason for these failures of 2015, Leander?
Well, I mean, just to go back super quick to the World Cups, if you're going to juxtapose 2014 with 2010, I think you also have to recognize that, yes, the U.S. had stronger opponents in Brazil than in South Africa. But if you look at the games and the sort of game by game, you know, in 2010, the U.S. played England and, you know, I think they got outplayed, but it wasn't a huge difference. They outplayed Slovenia. I think they should have won that game. And they outplayed Algeria. And then in the round of 16, they played a good Ghana team fairly evenly until they got that extra time goal. Now you fast forward 4 years, the U.S. gets clobbered by Ghana, but somehow wins 2-1. They played well against Portugal, and then Germany outplays them. I don't know that I buy this idea that there is some kind of unspoken handshake agreement, because if the U.S. wins that game, they're playing Algeria instead of Belgium. And then, of course, they got completely taken apart by Belgium in the round of 16. It's just that Belgium forgot to score goals. And I think that looking forward to 2015, there was no real stylistic cohesion in 2014 at the World Cup. It was just the same old bunker in and bail out. And that doesn't really work when you're playing in games where you have to break down opponents. I feel like at the World Cup, sure, you're playing the very best of teams and maybe you alter what you do a little bit. But I don't know that the U.S. under Klinsmann ever established what he likes to refer to as a house style and a system of winning games. And, you know, you look at the U.S. now, and you don't really know what it is that they do. You don't. I mean, Joe and I were talking about this the other day. You don't know what to expect from them. You don't know even what the formation, even though that's kind of an outdated notion now, is going to look like. Like, game to game, I have no idea what to expect. Half the time, I don't know who's going to be in the lineup. And I think in 2015, that lack of identity really caught up to them.
I think that I agree. I think, even, you know, going back to what you said about how the U.S. performed in 2014, the one game where you could argue the U.S. did outplay the opponents, the Portugal game, that's kind of, Portugal will let you have that. You know, Portugal is not the most possessive team in the world, so it's almost like that happened because it had to happen, because Portugal wanted it to, less because the U.S. imposed its will. And I think that the lack of consistency from the things Leander mentioned really kind of reared its ugly head this past summer at the Gold Cup. And I also wonder that, like I said, Klinsmann, for as personable as he is and as successful as he's been, can come off as a fairly arrogant guy. And he's definitely, you know, he's not one to shy away from ruffling feathers. And I almost wonder, because obviously I wasn't inside the locker room or anything like that, I almost wonder if by the time the Gold Cup rolled around in 2015, the players were a little sick of the way that he managed things and did things, and weren't really willing to fight for him like they would for others. And I think it was a combination of those factors that led to kind of, you know, calling 2015 a disaster might be too much of a step, but it was definitely a disappointment.
A national team player who shall remain nameless once said to me that Klinsmann was unbelievable as a motivator. Mm-hmm. But he said when he gets out on the field, he doesn't know what he's supposed to do. And that's a problem that I think maybe Bob Bradley had in the opposite way, where he, I mean, I've seen like footage of him talking to the team before the game, and I don't think he was that sort of rah-rah guy who could get the guys fired up. And he was more about having this polished message where he could sort of convey to the players, this is what you're supposed to do. And with Bradley, at the very least, and this is why I say that I think history will reflect pretty well on him, you knew what you were going to see. And you weren't excited about seeing it necessarily, but you knew what it was going to look like. You knew how the U.S. was going to play, what they were supposed to do. Even sitting in the stands or in the press box or sitting at home, you knew what each player's assignment was, more or less. And with Bradley, that just isn't there. I'm sorry, with Klinsmann, that isn't there. And you just, And it seems that at least one player felt the same way, where there is just not a design behind it that can be perceived by anybody but him.
Do you guys think that Klinsmann's lack of a plan as far as being able to build a regular first team, a first 11, I don't think outside of maybe Josie Altidore, Michael Bradley, and Jermaine Jones, you can say who are going to be, you know, locks in his first 11. Do you think his reliance on being able to motivate players, just picking whoever's the hot prospect or whoever's up and coming, and mixing in some of his old standbys, do you think that's why it's been this lack of cohesion, this uncertainty? I want to characterize it as just flying by the seat of his pants, but the fact that do you think Klinsmann just relies on those motivational skills? Is that the reason why he operates the way he has?
I think Klinsmann has a little bit of coaching ADD, where he is shuffling his lineup so much that, you know, that how many different back lines have we seen in the last 2 years? Yeah. Even going into the World Cup, all of a sudden Omar Gonzalez was out and Jeff Cameron was back in, and then it was then Cameron would come in halfway through the game. And, you know, the only spots really where he hasn't tinkered perpetually is central midfield and up front, and everywhere and in goal. But everywhere else, he's just shuffling guys in and out. And I mean, guys like Fabian Johnson, who have played left half, right half, left back, right back. Michael Bradley's an attacking midfielder, then he's defensive midfielder, then he's a number eight. You know, Dempsey played as a striker at the World Cup, but before that he was a 10. Or, you know, he's moving guys around all the time. And I think as a national team, when you don't play together that much, especially when you don't practice together all that much, that becomes really hard for the team. So I don't know necessarily that he's enabled them to get the best out of themselves, but by constantly tinkering with stuff. And maybe he does think that by saying the right words and getting them fired up before the game, that'll sort of compensate for all of that. But I don't think the results have borne that out.
It definitely seems like something's missing when he with him on the sideline. It's whether it's tactically or inconsistent tactics, whatever. You know, the bottom line is that there is too much. There's too much tinkering going on. There's not a consistent enough and a fluid enough plan in place, regardless of whatever it may be, however you may feel like this team should be playing. And even on a different level, you have, you know, if you're in the national team pool for a particular country, you kind of know who's there with you. Klinsmann's made a big deal about plucking players from Germany who were born on military bases, have some, you know, American father or mother. And, well, this is certainly not to question anyone's heritage. You know, you are eligible who to play for because of who you are. I don't know if, like, the players kind of think, like, well, who's he going to bring in next week? Like, he plays favorites, clearly. It's like, who's he going to bring in that we've never heard of who might be competing for my spot or might cause something?
From the college ranks, perhaps.
Yeah, and, like, there's no consistency to it, and it's hard if you want to talk about Klinsmann flying by the seat of his pants, the players are almost forced to do that with the way that he manages the team, and that's obviously not ideal.
Guys, let's take a time out. We spent a good chunk of time on the first 4 years of the Klinsmann era. After the break, we'll talk about the promise of a new year and a fresh start in 2016. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, direct from the FC Yahoo Soccer blog at yahoosports.com. And if you're looking for a sports radio morning show that is just a little bit more entertaining and has a little bit of fun, along with all your coverage of sports every morning, check out the Steve Zabin Show, direct from Yahoo Sports Radio.
Possibility of more donuts to come.
Yes. A new donut at 7-Eleven. Donuts. You want to take a guess as to the flavor of the donut?
A chocolate.
No, they got those.
Sriracha.
So it's new. Maple bacon.
Sriracha.
Everything's sriracha nowadays.
Sriracha in it. Yeah.
It really is.
Sriracha, tropical
fruit.
Sriracha
didn't even exist as a flavor when I was a kid. Another 7-Eleven staple.
Slurpee.
Yes. Ding, ding, ding. Slurpee flavored donuts.
But what, what flavor?
Slurpees flavor?
What flavor Slurpee?
Yes. Yes, the red or cherry.
Steve Zabin, mornings, 6 a.m. until 10 a.m. Eastern on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Listen live and check out the podcast of the Steve Zabin Show, yahoosportsradio.com.
It's time to get back to everything, football and soccer from across the world. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast from Yahoo Sports Radio and Yahoo Sports. Once again, your host. Once again, your host, Joe Lago.
We are back. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Lago, the editor of the FC Yahoo blog. I'm with Joey Galino and Leander Charlackins. Guys, we spent a good amount of time going over the first 4 years of Jurgen Klinsmann's time as U.S. men's national team coach. 2015 did not end in the most positive manner. The loss to Mexico in the CONCACAF Cup with a Confederations Cup place at stake at the Rose Bowl was really was probably rock bottom for Jurgen Klinsmann and his time as USMNT coach. But they did end up close out 2015 with a win in World Cup qualifying over St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and a draw with Trinidad and Tobago, which takes us to 2016. And as I mentioned, a fresh start and the promise of a new year. Guys, what are the reasons for optimism?
I think I'll start with the fact that you mentioned it. We were all at the Confed Cup playoff or whatever it was called against Mexico at the Rose Bowl back in October. And if for as exciting as the game it turned out to be, and for as great of a goal as Mexico won on, you know, it was a great strike. You can't take anything away from it. U.S. got pretty outplayed in that game. And as we saw in 2015, that wasn't necessarily an isolated incident. But I do think that if you're coming into 2016 and you just ended the year with that loss and then the St. Vincent and the Grenadines win and then the draw at Trinidad and Tobago in World Cup qualifying, the fact that I was pumped and other fans were pumped about that draw kind of says where the United States was at that moment in time. And you almost have to wonder, did the end of 2015 represent a bottoming out and the U.S. is kind of bounced back? Because these things always, you know, international soccer is so funny. Like, it's elastic that way. You can bounce back and forth. Just ask Mexico the past few years. So I would say that that's a good place to start, saying, okay, we can't actually have things be any worse than they were at the end of 2015, can we? And you look at what's coming up, you have the home-and-home and qualifying with Guatemala, which figures to, you know, you don't take anything for granted with the U.S. these days, but figures to yield 6 points in those two matches. And then you have the Copa this summer, which is in the United States and offers a chance to go against some of the very best teams and players in the world. And while the Confederations Cup in 2017 is already out of the picture, it's kind of like, okay, that's done. You know, there's nothing you can do about that now. So let's move forward and see what we can make out of the opportunities we have in qualifying and in the Copa America Centenario this summer.
I think if you're looking for reasons to be optimistic, you can find some. I mean, out of the U.S.'s last four games, they've won three and tied one. But if you look a little closer, there's that 6-1 win over St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Well, they actually went behind in that game, which is sort of unforgivable. You've got the away tie with Trinidad and Tobago. And I've covered some of those away CONCACAF qualifiers, and they're hard. It doesn't matter how sort of weak the opponent is. The atmosphere and the humidity and all of that stuff sort of conspires against you. And those are difficult games. But all the same, If this is a U.S. national team that we're projecting, I mean, Klinsmann set as his target to reach the semifinals in Russia in 2018. Well, then you should probably still win away at Trinidad and Tobago. Okay, so now the first two games of 2016, the U.S. won. They beat Iceland 3-2, but they are actually behind in that game twice, and one on a 90th minute Steve Birnbaum little scramble goal, as I recall. And they beat Canada, but that came on an 89th minute winner from Jozy Altidore after a pretty terrible game. So, you know, you can read this in a lot of different ways. But you talk about a team bottoming out and sort of the bouncy ball effect of international soccer, and especially when you compare it to Mexico. Yes, Mexico has bounced up and down, but they've also changed their managers an awful lot. They've had probably half a dozen managers in the time that Klinsmann has been in charge, if not more. And so those bounces and those crests in form tend to happen when there's a managerial change and everything switches up a little bit. So I don't know that we can expect that from the U.S. necessarily if there isn't that big shock to the system of a new appointment.
The Copa America is in June. I believe it starts June 3rd. Mm-hmm. What should Klinsmann try to accomplish, or what should he accomplish from now until June? What do you think needs to get done?
I think it's interesting because it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the way the team plays. The draw for the Copa America was not particularly kind to the United States. Colombia, Costa Rica, and Paraguay, while maybe Colombia, but you know, there's no Brazils or Argentinas in the group, or Chile is out there too, the defending Copa America champion. It is kind of a tricky group from top to bottom, and so you're not going to get, maybe outside of Colombia, you're not going to get that signature scalp, so to speak. Excuse me, but you can look to see how the team plays, and if the team has an attacking mindset, and if it's fluid, and if the passing is there, and if the effort is there, and everybody's working for each other and fighting for each other, and to get out of the green, you know, we've seen what happens when Jurgen Klinsmann goes to these things. He won the Gold Cup. He got out of the group stage at the World Cup. We've seen the results. We've seen, you know, the end game. I think what we'd like to see is to have the team look a little bit better, maybe look like it has a plan, an identity, and then let the results fall where they may.
But what's going to be new? Like, who is he going to introduce? Who is he going to whose role is going to increase in order for them to achieve that, to play this improved style of soccer, to have better results?
Well, I think if Klinsmann deserves credit for anything, it's that he isn't like a lot of other national team coaches where he just has his guys and he sticks to them. You know, they're sort of his ride or die, and he sticks with them forever and ever. He deserves credit for that. I mean, obviously, that has also resulted in him ditching Landon Donovan, and at one point, Clint Dempsey was out of the mix, who was his former captain. But he has introduced some talent that I think can be helpful. I mean, DeAndre Yedlin, I think he's sort of limited in some ways, but he brings a lot in other ways. And you've got, you know, Fabian Johnson has been great in midfield. He's been around a little while, but Darlington Nagby shows promise. I think Ethan Finley might be helpful. Mm-hmm. Giassi Zardes has come along. Bobby Wood, after a very slow and sort of tentative start with the national team, I think is really coming around nicely. So I think he's been good at Jerome Kiesewetter. I think we'd be remiss not to mention. I think there's guys that he's identified that can help in the long run. I think the overarching problem there is that he never sticks with one lineup long enough for it to sort of get comfortable. But the Copa is going to be a strange litmus test because it's such a stacked tournament, and everybody knows that it's going to be tough to get out of the group. Should they? You know, you could argue about that based on past performance in World Cups and such, probably, but based on the form of the last year, maybe not. But so at once that means that he's got sort of a baked-in excuse if the U.S. doesn't advance. Although, you know, the general public, you know, the non-soccer nerdy crowd may have a hard time understanding it. But so he has this built-in excuse, which I wonder if he can sort of seize upon that to take a little bit more risk. And unlike the World Cup, you know, not just bunker in and give these young and more technical guys a chance to actually show what they can do. And I'd be really interested to see how these next two qualifiers with Guatemala play out. And if we can take any hints from them, if he does, you know, set those guys loose a little bit.
Who would you guys like to see get more run? I mean, is it Nagby? Nagby apparently wasn't setting the January camp on fire, which is why He only came on as a sub, I think, in those two friendlies. Mm-hmm. But is there any one player that you guys are hoping or expecting to see, break out maybe?
Well, I think that Darlington Nagbe is one of them. You'd like to see him kind of take more command in the midfield and be more of a playmaker. I think Giassi Zardes, while he is a name that is known because he's been getting, you know, regular playing time with the national team now for about a year or longer, he's someone there's still a huge element of untapped potential there. I feel like DeAndre Yedlin's a different player because he's a little bit thicker and stronger on the ball and maybe even a little bit faster. But I feel like that Zardes can have that kind of impact on the wing and he can set things up for the offense. He can put moves on out there to get into good areas. He can play good balls in. You know, he can maybe be opportunistic around the box. And like the going back to Klinsmann's earlier in his tenure, the 2013 run to the World Cup and when winning the Hex was built largely on Jozy Altidore being in the form of his life. And if another player can kind of find that form, but a new player, it'd be one thing if Clint Dempsey and Michael Bradley have to do everything, or Tim Howard has to make 100 billion saves or something like that. You really want to see the Nagbes, you want to see the Giassi Zardes, the Bobby Woods, who he had a goal in the Confederation Cup playoff. You want to see those guys really start to take ownership of the national team, because these other guys aren't going to be around forever.
Zardes is a strange case to me, actually, because he's 24. He's only 2 years younger than Jozy Altidore. Mm-hmm. It's just that he went off and played in college for 4 years. So I'm always a little bit reluctant to pin too much hope on him, because at 24, you're not a prospect anymore. You're pretty close to what you're going to be on the national team. You're pretty much the fully formed product, even if you are a late bloomer. And then Nagbe, he's 25. Finley is 25. Yedlin is 22. So he's got a little bit of upside left. So while I'm sort of contradicting myself here, because I do think those guys show promise, but I think there's a real danger in projecting too much upside to those guys, because they are sort of fairly old, and that's because of the college system and other things. But if looked at that way, sort of as a counterpoint to what I was saying before, is there really enough talent coming through? Can we see a national team in 5 years' time where Zardes and Nagbe and guys like that are the main players, and the U.S. is still consistently reaching the World Cup and doing well in the Gold Cup and everything? Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure. Looked at that way, I'm maybe a little bit worried.
I think there's also a bunch of names that are plying their trade over in Europe right now. The Emerson Heinemanns, Christian Pulisic at Borussia Dortmund, and maybe they're not
Gedeon Zelalem,
and maybe they're not old enough yet to take the reins in the national team. But those are guys I'd like to see maybe sprinkled into the mix a little bit more, because what they've done so far in their careers makes it maybe a little bit easier to say there's room for them to grow. They're already in pretty solid spots. Those are the guys that you can see taking over in the future. And Jordan Morris is another name that I'd throw in there. I know we were very high on him, and he just signed a huge contract with Seattle. But I think a lot of us believe Europe is in his future. And so those are the guys, I think, that maybe Klinsmann will call some of them up for this summer and kind of see what they can do, because they weren't on the 26-man for these two qualifiers. But obviously a lot can change between now and June.
Let's not forget the prospects along the back line. I mean, you got Matt Miazga, who's now at Chelsea.
Yes, we do. The future.
Cameron Carter-Vickers, mm-hmm. who is he still 18?
At Spurs?
At Tottenham.
I think so, yeah.
There's hope along the back line, but I think it still remains an unknown and a concern, guys, if we're to be honest about the U.S.'s kind of ever-changing back four. And then you throw in the form of Tim Howard and Brad Guzan. Guzan recently got his starting job back at Aston Villa, but Villa is going down.
Yep.
And Howard is sitting on the bench. What are we to make of the situation or the state of the U.S. defense?
I think there's sort of a sudden panic there, especially in goal, because Howard has, you know, we all love the guy, right? I mean, he was great at the World Cup, and he's really, truly a wonderful person.
He's the best interview.
He's the best interview, but he's also just such a nice guy. You get to know him a little bit, and he's just such a gentleman. And I'm not one to fawn over players, but Howard really is a great guy. But if we're being honest, he's really fallen off since the World Cup. Brad Guzan has, you know, he's a starter in the Premier League, unlike Howard now, but he's not had a great year. You know, and he's never really elevated to that point Howard was at for 5 or 6 years, where he was saving points in the Premier League. He's just kind of a serviceable Premier League goalkeeper at the moment on a team that is going to get relegated. And I don't know that he has played well enough that some other Premier League team will pick him up and make him a starter. And so now you start looking at the guys behind him, and you begin to question Nick Raimondo being the third goalkeeper for the last few years, because he's 36, so he's not going to offer a solution. Luis Robles has been great in the MLS, but he's 31, you know, going on 32. So, you know, you kind of wonder about that. And then Bill Hamid is maybe the heir apparent, but he's injured at the moment, and he's going to be for a long time. Sean Johnson has had his wobbles. And then the other two goalkeepers that have been called up for this roster, William Yarbrough and David Bingham, have 3 caps between them, and they're 26 and 27. So now suddenly you have a big gap back there, and potentially really a problem unless Howard really takes these 3.5 years that he's going to have with the Colorado Rapids as of this summer and make some kind of big resurgence.
And the one thing that's encouraging about that is that goalkeepers tend to be, you can play still at a fairly elite level by and large, even into your late 30s. The shelf life is much longer than it is for outfield players. So even if there isn't a glaring, you know, solution back there, there's still time, and there's still, you know, Guzan and Howard, maybe Howard more so than Guzan, it's not like they're going to have to retire tomorrow, so maybe you can hope that they can find that form again. I think the back line really hinges on one of Klinsmann's, one of his boys. Miazga's a great guy for the future, but right now, if John Brooks can become kind of that linchpin in the center of defense, and he's had a pretty good year for Hertha BSC. I think they're third right now in the Bundesliga, so he's getting good experience there. If he can become the linchpin and become more than just the guy who headed in the winning goal against Ghana, then I think that bodes well going forward. But again, it's going to come down to, is Klinsmann, he's already shown him a long rope, but is Klinsmann going to let him make mistakes and let him grow with the same relative group of people around him? And we're just not sure about that at this point, but I think that's someone who offers a little bit of hope as well.
Guys, let's go. We're going to have to wrap things up here, but, you know, we spent much of the show talking about the Klinsmann era. I just want to get your guys' take on how would you define success for 2016 for Jurgen, and what about his right now? How would you assess his legacy as U.S. coach? So, Leander, you want to tackle that?
2016 is obviously, you know, reaching the final round of World Cup qualifying. I think that should be pretty well attainable. You know, he should do that without any problem. The under-23s at least making the playoff against Colombia, that they're also playing on Friday and next week Tuesday, making that close at the very least, because I think they're going to be outgunned. And getting out of the group at the Copa America. I think if he can do those things, that's a pretty successful year. For his overall legacy, you know, if you did a thought experiment, and I know that sounds pretentious, but bear with me. If you imagine that Jurgen Klinsmann, when he was hired, was a guy that you had never heard of before, and there wasn't all of this hype, you would say that he's been a pretty good U.S. national team coach, because he has a higher winning percentage than any other U.S. coach who's had at least 3 games in charge. The only U.S. coach who has more wins than he does is Bruce Arena. He has 26 more wins, but he was in charge for 59 more games than Jurgen Klinsmann was. And, you know, if you didn't know beforehand that he was supposed to be this big deal and that he was going to be paid 4 times as much as Bob Bradley was, you might look at this guy and say, you know, he's done all right. But given the expectation, and to sort of circle back to the start of this discussion, all that was expected of him, and more importantly, all that he told us he was going to do. You know, the attacking soccer and the pretty soccer and the next level, even if that maybe didn't so much come from him. Looked at that way, he's been a disappointment. So, you know, if his tenure ended today, I would say it was a flop. But he's got a little bit of time left.
Yeah, I think that when you ask the question of what would constitute success in 2016 for the U.S. men's national team, where it is at this point, I would almost say I would rather ask what constitutes not failing. And I think that not a lot of people would expect the under-23s to beat Colombia and get into the Olympics. Clearly, that would be a success if they did so. But again, like Leander said, if they can play well and give a good account of themselves against a really good nation, that would be a success in my eyes. And again, as crazy as this sounds to say, if there's a consistent plan this summer at the Copa, and a consistent way the U.S. sets up, or at least the philosophy that it seems is there, and for some reason the brakes don't go the team's way, not getting out of the group stages I don't think would necessarily constitute failure or constitute not being successful, because it is a tricky group, it is a tough group, and I don't think it can be so black and white to say, like, we have to get out of the first round, we have to get out of the group stage for it to be a success. And then clearly, the getting to the next round, the final round of the Hex in World Cup qualifying, is almost something that has to be done. It can't be seen as a success. It's almost a no-win situation. It can't be seen as a success if you do it, but it's definitely a failure if you don't do it. So I think that you have to put things in the proper context in terms of what the United States has an opportunity to do this year to be successful. But yes, just to sum it up, I would say that giving a good account of yourself in Olympic qualifying and then getting out of the group stage in the summer at the Copa and qualifying for the final round of the Hex would be the successful year.
I'm going to use Sunil Gulati's words on the day that Klinsmann got hired. The words advance the program. Now, it wasn't said as a goal, but that's how he described Jurgen. And if I go by that, I would say, if I was nice, I would say it's an incomplete.
Yes.
But right now, if I had to give him a grade, it's pass or fail. He's failing. And for a lot of things that we've touched on, and what you just said, he just has not built a team yet. He has gone through, well, in the lead up to the 2014 World Cup. Leander, how many players did you go through? Almost 60 players he was using. I don't know what the exact number was, but...
At one point, he had used 100 in, like, the first few years of his tenure.
So he has gone to, you know, great lengths to find whatever talent he could find. He has recruited some players that the U.S. never would have been able to wear the U.S. shirt. But, you know, going back to Gulati's words, advance the program. There's no advancement that I can see. The optics, the eye test, it doesn't pass. Mm-hmm. It doesn't pass that.
It doesn't.
So we got to end it on that note, guys. Thanks for the honest assessment of our beloved U.S. men's national team and Jurgen Klinsmann. Be sure to subscribe to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast on iTunes. And as always, you can find all of our insights on soccer in the FC Yahoo blog on Yahoo Sports. For Joey Galino, Leander Charlakins, I'm Joe Lago. You have been listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. Goodbye for now. Bouncing.